This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I don't know why, but in my brain, it was a unicorn, but it never was. And so, unbeknownst to me, I kept calling it the unicorn ribbon, and everyone was like, what is he talking about? Finally, we connected the dots that there was never a unicorn. And so to fix it, I just asked for little pearls to be embroidered as the unicorn horns on top of it.
I love that. Hello and welcome to the Art of Costume Podcast. I'm Elizabeth Joy Glass.
And thou art Spencer Williams. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Spencer. I'm surprised you didn't call yourself a lord for this one.
Oh, yeah, huh. That was kind of a missed opportunity.
You did. See, you're not a real lord.
This was
more
our only
evidence.
We are in our first Shakespeare month, so this really was my opportunity.
It was, and you missed it. You have two chances. You missed your first one.
Oh, man. Elizabeth, are you excited for Shakespeare month? We all know you have beef with William Shakespeare.
I am. So, thing is, I really only hate Romeo and Juliet. Otherwise, I'm cool with Shakespeare. Love Shakespeare.
Okay. I'm sure he's glad to hear that.
Yeah, I know it's after how many hundreds of years, my opinion is what matters to him in the afterlife. So glad we straightened that out.
All right. Ooh, Elizabeth, I have a serious update for you.
Okay.
I thought these are done, but I have a small popcorn update.
Okay. I want to know. Did you get a small popcorn?
I finally got a small popcorn.
Yay!
It just happened magically. You know, for the people behind the scenes who are listening to this, I have been ruthlessly been trying to get down from the large 12-gallon bowl of popcorn at the movies down to a small. But I've always been too scared to ask for it because
you just ask. You're giving them money. You just ask for it.
But the other day, I don't know how it happened, but I guess I had a headache. I was in sweats. I looked like a zombie. And I don't know how it happened, but I for some reason said it. And he was like, oh, well, you could just get the combo meal if you're a member. And I was like, oh, I am a member. And he's like, oh, okay, well, here's the small popcorn. And it was that easy. And I almost passed out.
Yeah, I told you. I told you it was not that hard.
So
you didn't believe me.
A year later, I have finally got a small popcorn at the movies. And guess what? I still didn't finish it.
I told you. See, our American consumerism it's pointless. You're not what, saving money by getting the large, because you're never going to finish it.
Yeah. And then I watched Babylon. So you would think I would have nervously ate all that popcorn. But anyways, enough about me. Let's get into Shakespeare month. Elizabeth, what are we watching this week?
Yes. This week we watched Rosalyn. I was so excited for this movie because it's everything Romeo and Juliet should be, but it's not.
Finally, a movie that I was when I watched it, I was did Elizabeth write this movie? Because this is how she talks about the movie all the time.
Yes, it was a cautionary tale. And at the end of the day, in spoiler warnings, once they're in that boat, they can see they're not right for each other. He's too stupid for her.
It was funny. I was laughing pretty hard. I was I could not wait to talk about this. And the costumes were so good. I felt there should be a museum for all these costumes. Every single one. I was okay. I wrote so many notes.
They're historically accurate while still being fresh and fun, and they feel very youthful. So it was just so perfect. And we should really just dive into this. Spencer, start with that summary.
Okay. So Roslyn is a forward-thinking, ambitious young lady from the House of Capulet. She has been secretly seeing Romeo, a member of the Capulet's rivals, the Montagues, and promises to meet him at the Capulet Masquerade Ball. But things don't exactly work out. This comedic retelling of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, told from the point of view of Romeo's jilted ex, Roslyn, the woman Romeo first claims to love before he falls for Juliet. And that is Roslyn.
That is Roslyn. Let's go behind the wardrobe. We have director Karen Main and designer Mitchell Travers.
Yay.
you will know him from Eighth Grade, Late Night, Hustlers, In the Heights, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which we have done an episode on.
Yes.
And then also George and Tammy, which Spencer, you did an interview for.
Yeah, I finally got to meet Mitchell, I don't know, like a month ago now, and I'm still listening to George and Tammy music. It is so bad. I'm sure my neighbors are ready to come over and murder me. such a good show. I've told every single person I know about the show.
That's one thing I have to get on, but let's continue to go behind the wardrobe, and we couldn't think of a better way to go behind the wardrobe than to have Mitchell on the show. Welcome.
Mitchell, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, we're so excited.
I feel like I just left. I'm back again.
I know. Actually, when I talked to Mitchell the first time, I was like, oh, by the way, Shakespeare Month is coming up and we've already assumed that you're going to do this episode with us. So thank God he said yes.
Yeah.
I love you guys and I love your show. So I'm happy to be here, truly.
You know what?
Well, we're actually going to take a quick little break. And when we come back, we're going to get right into it.
This is my favorite music when it comes in right here. This
oh,
is
yeah. I love that. Let's get into Roslyn. This, honestly, one of my favorite movies of 2022. Obviously, its take on Romeo and Juliet takes place in Verona during the Italian Renaissance. With this being like one of your first like major period films, I imagine you had to do a lot of research, which must have been exciting.
It was an enormous amount of research. You know, I didn't come into this with some wealth of 15th century knowledge of costume outside of, you know, what I studied in school. So it was an enormous undertaking and a huge challenge to have to go and look at, you know, paintings as reference, right?
Oh, wow.
So many of us are used to doing mood boards with like, you know, fashion imagery and, or, you know, vintage photos of magazines and that sort of stuff for our work. So to actually, you know, have to go to the Met to look at what I was about to do, it really shifted me into a very new way of working and thinking and designing. So I definitely had that first day where I was like, oh, whoa, this is like a whole new level.
Right. We're not doing Hustlers anymore.
Yeah, there's no stress involved here, ladies and gentlemen. Real deal. But it was great. I mean, it was really exciting to sort of like shift the way I think and dream about costumes and use some of the most inspiring work. I mean, it's hanging in the most famous museums across our planet, right? So it was hugely inspiring to start with paintings.
Oh, I love that. I love the Italian Renaissance. I'm a big Renaissance nerd. I remember learning a lot about that in school too. So it was really cool to see it kind of be translated into a film like this. One thing that stood out to me was how beautiful the textiles were. Everything felt very rich and authentic. I mean, the textiles felt like they came out of a Renaissance painting to me. What was it like working for all these textiles?
Honestly, it was a complete thrill to get to see how they're made. You know, we shot this in Italy, so I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I found the biggest challenge, of course, like you look at the research and you see the scale of the print, on the fabric. And it's so difficult to find that scale now because, you know, we're not making clothes with print the size of our bodies, right? That's like not really something that we do. And so then you have to sort of lean on like, are you going to go down that upholstery route? Because so many period costumes look like upholstery. And that's, I think a lot of times in a vacuum, people think that we have all the time in the world to create these costumes. But in fact, it is very fast paced. You're having to produce a large volume of clothing, you know, in a matter of a few weeks. So getting something milled or getting something printed, there's often not that much time. So you have to be very clever about what you're using and how you're going to use it, especially in a piece like this. So I immediately got to work. I started my research just about where I could still get textiles. There's the insane part of working in Italy is that there are looms that have been producing the same textile for hundreds and hundreds of years. They're still operational and they're still manufactured in the same way. So I did discover a few mills that would produce, you know, exactly what I needed, which was a huge win. And then just being in Italy, there is a bit more of that feeling into some of the fabric. So I was in Venice one time on the weekend, and I know how this sounds. Yes, I do. But I was in Venice on the weekend. I passed by this small shop, and in the back of the shop, and I feel like costume designers have a knack for this. Like we almost have like a nose. Like we don't know what we're looking for, but we just get these instincts to go into these little places. And I went in, and it was mostly like, you know, curtains and laces and things for home decoration. And then I got in the back, and there was like all of this fabric rolled up and stored vertical. I could tell that like what I was looking at was the scale of what I wanted. And so I, you know, in my very, very poor Italian, was trying to talk to the man about what he did. And he started to unroll these bolts, and they were truly like from my research. It was perfect. They were massive.
Oh, wow.
Silks and brocades and just some of the most extraordinary textiles. And I ended up getting so much fabric there. I had no way to get it home because I was living in Rome for this project. So
just a little place called Rome.
Right. And so I have, you know, like a few hundred pounds of fabric in Venice, and trying to talk to my Italian crew, like, okay, I went for it. I went crazy. There's like all of these bolts that we need to figure out getting back up to the shop this week. But it was pretty fantastic. I mean, there's my friend Massimo, now my friend Massimo, has some of the most extraordinary fabrics in Italy. I mean, we could never afford some of the things that he's able to produce, but on the more film friendly side of things, he did have these brilliant textiles like this Roslin dress that we're looking at, this bottom. It was this, I saw a little sample of it, and it just lived in my head for a few weeks. And eventually I was like, bite the bullet, make the dress. Let's go.
Right.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. So like part of the textile then you're saying is, it had to do with like the scale of the prints we were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Ugh, so gorgeous. And what else was gorgeous? I know, Mitchell, you probably know from listening to the podcast, but Elizabeth and I love a ball. So this was no exception. The Capulet ball was interesting in that it was monochromatic, but the costume still felt unique throughout the ball. So take us back to the ball and your ideas behind it.
Well, I feel like I really love a costume ball in a movie. I love them. And I just felt like a version of it that I I hadn't really seen yet was color specific, right? Like I feel like often the palette is really worked out by the designer with beautiful balance between hues. And I felt like our movie called for something different and fresh and unexpected because of its script, right? It's a different look at a story we feel like we know quite well. And it's that Romeo meets Juliet moment, but of course we're on a different team for this version of it. Yeah. I wanted this idea that it was like, you know, you could get caught up, you could lose yourself, or you could lose somebody else, or, you know, you could see somebody across the room and not be able to get back to them at that same ball. And so I wanted just this like swirling sea of red. It's like passion and love, and it's, you know, first blush. So many great things that you get from the feeling red can give you on camera. So, you know, I do think my Italian crew wanted to murder me when I said we can only use red, right? Because we're offering like 200 extras in costume.
You're like, how do you say murder in Italian?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, they were great sports, right? Like they would go to the ends of the earth to try to get what we wanted on camera. And they're the most fantastic, fantastic crews in Italy. So we started working with a ton of rental houses throughout Europe. You'd be surprised, but there's not a ton of movies made in this period. So the stock is limited, right? There's not rows and rows and rows of garments. So we had people pulling for us in London. I went to Spain. We have all of the, you know, fantastic and extremely historical costume houses there in Italy. So we just pulled as much as we could from all over the world, and we got a few hundred extras in red head to toe. And I have to admit to you, it was one of those things where I was like, at some point we're going to have to pull in another color, right? There just won't be enough,
right?
Enough time.
There's not enough red fabric in the world.
Yeah. And I had Paris costumes in Spain. They built a ton for us for this as well. But we got it. It was pretty much red head to toe. I couldn't believe it. It was like by the skin of our teeth, but we were able to make it happen. And it felt like what I wanted, because we were there on set and you had all of this, you know, gorgeous fabric surrounded you all in red with different adornments and silhouettes. And you kind of did lose people in it. Like it was kind of hard to find somebody again once you had done last looks on them, which was exactly the point, right? You want that feeling of Romeo meets Juliet and then they can't find each other again.
Right.
They get separated.
It's like what we always talk about. I mean, the costume design was really driving the storytelling at this moment, which is pretty awesome.
Another awesome character. I fell in love with Roslyn. She was so incredible. And she's really going through it, dealing with the absurdity that is Romeo and Juliet. But even despite these boy problems she is having, she is looking fabulous all the time. Could you talk about the like overall story behind Roslyn's looks and your collaboration with the actress, Caitlin?
Caitlin is extraordinary. She's so cool. She brings such a great light to so many rooms that she's in. And we had a really great first meeting where we talked about this character and what she wanted to bring to it, what I wanted to bring to it. And we both felt pretty similarly that what we're doing is a movie about like the friend, right? This is the friend character, but in our movie, she is our protagonist. And so in the way that in movies like this, you know, the leading lady is like, you know, light and blonde and blues and periwinkles and soft. And that's what we're used to with Juliet, you know, here. Mm-hmm. We're like, we need the opposite. It's the best friend character. So we need like density and weight and red hair and velvets and things that feel like, for costume design, you know, things that we put on those secondary characters are now our focus. So we wanted this kind of outsider energy on our leading lady. And I became obsessed with what I called like Botticelli blonde, which is this like blonde thing.
We know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I just became obsessed with that as my palette. So it was like, I was looking at iron and rust and salmon and coral and these tertiary colors that we often reserve for that secondary character became my palette for our lead. which was really fun. There was sort of like almost if you were to do a contemporary film and you wanted to do like a twist on menswear for a character, I tried to do the same thing just in the 15th century, looking at some of those harder shapes to put on our leading lady. And I had a really fun time putting it together.
Yeah, I love that because she really is, even within the story, she is, you know, a woman that does not subscribe to the norm. So I love that. One specific detail I really loved was the dragonfly detail on the dress she's meant to wear to the Capulet ball. And I read that there's a little bit of symbolism behind this.
So it's like the most romantic thing in the world, but there are a ton of dragonflies in Italy in the summer when we were there. And so I kept seeing them all the time. And like, you know, they're such magical things when you see them, right? Like you're captivated by them. And in a conversation, Caitlin and I started talking about dragonflies because we were seeing them as we were at some of these locations. And then I became obsessed with the idea and I started seeing, it's one of those things, like once it's something that you notice, you see it everywhere. So I started to find imagery of dragonflies in the paintings that I was looking at. I found it in stained glass. I found it in so many places. And I started to realize like something's going on with dragonflies. I need to go down the rabbit hole. And so what I found is that actually in, you know, we were roughly like 1460, give or take. But I found that there was, you know, like all periods in history, there are trends. And in 1460, there was a trend of dragonflies as symbolism. It made its way into, like I said, stained glass. It made its way onto cutlery, jewelry. This imagery of dragonflies came up and it became sort of a symbol of finding your way and being on the right path. And so we just felt like this is perfect for Rosalind, right? Like She is finding her way. She is on the right path. She thinks she's headed towards one goal, but in fact, like who she's surrounded by, spoiler alert, is exactly where she's meant to be. And it's part of being on the right course. So once that was locked in, I was like, we're doing a dragonfly dress. We have to. So I went to a metal worker and we found these dragonflies that we created to run down the front of this dress. And it was like sort of for me and Caitlin, it was a little bit of the culmination of all of our little chats about these dragonflies and the history and the dresses. And so just felt like the right thing to put on her when she's with Dario.
That's gorgeous. I'm obsessed. That. I mean, this is why we love costume design. Little details like that, that, you know, maybe not everyone will notice, but there's so much thought behind it. It's incredible.
It really opened my eyes though to trends throughout time, because, you know, I think so many times when we look at periods of history that we can't necessarily relate to, they feel static and still, but we've always been dressing ourselves the same way. Ultimately, like shapes come and go and layers come and go, but we've had color come in and out in trends. We've had jewelry styles come in and out in trends, prints, solids. And so it really humanized a lot of the faces that I was looking at, where I realized like, oh, you were just getting dressed in the same way that I am, right? You had a lot fewer clothes, but they were much more beautiful. But, you know, I joked about this in my post about this, but it was like, you know, the owl necklace of the 2010s. Like,
yeah.
This is that. Right. It's a young girl following the trends of her time and trying to fit in, trying to express herself, trying to have some individuality. It's very relatable to the way that we still dress ourselves today.
That's so true. My mind is blown right now.
I love that. Wow. Also with Rosalind, she's like a little more sophisticated. And when you put her next to Juliet, she definitely looks a little more sophisticated because Juliet definitely has like a pureness and a vulnerability to her a little bit. Were you establishing a contrast between the two?
Certainly. I think it was really important that Juliet felt younger than Rosalind. You know, Rosalind thinks of herself as a woman of the world, whereas Juliet is sort of just coming into her own and discovering the world and her place in it. And so we wanted this little sister energy from Juliet that Rosalind takes under her wing. I got hugely inspired by etched glass. There's a lot of beautiful pitchers and vases and goblets that still exist from the period. And I just got really inspired by that transparency and the lightness and the fragility of the pieces I was looking at. And I just tried to interpret that through clothing for her. There was a connection I couldn't break.
Yeah. One scene I especially liked that contrast was the bar scene. Because especially Juliet has like, I think it's like a unicorn embroidered on her top. And it's just very flowery. And then Roslyn is like deep colors, has this beautiful like jeweled headpiece. I was like, that is like a beautiful contrast between these two.
You got it perfectly. It's exactly what we wanted. I sort of did the bar as like our biker bar. So there was a ton of leather. Yeah. One of this like crude male sweaty energy. I used to joke, but I was like, you know what they say about showering, you know, like I think this place would reek. It should be like kind of off-putting to be here. And then to have this like little doe-eyed unicorn wearing this bar, it's like we want that shock to her system, right? She's learning about the world, she's learning about men. And then the unicorn trim is actually quite funny because it's a piece of vintage ribbon that I found at my favorite vintage ribbon dealer. There's not many, but she is my favorite in New York. And it was something I bought like early on in the thing. This is sort of the way I costume. I like gather stuff. I don't know exactly where I'm going to put it, but I know it has the right feeling for me. And I don't know why, but in my brain, it was a unicorn, but it never was. And so unbeknownst to me, I kept calling it the unicorn ribbon and everyone was like, what is he talking about? Finally, we connected the dots that there was never a unicorn. And so to fix it, I just asked for little pearls to be embroidered as the unicorn horns on top of it.
I love that.
Correct my memory a little bit there. But yes, she became known in our costume shop as the unicorn dress that was ultimately never a unicorn. But we made sure to correct that.
I'm obsessed. I actually didn't even notice the unicorn. So now I feel like we need a pause and I need to go turn the movie back on. But we'll keep going. I'll do that later. I feel really jealous right now. What I did notice, though, Paris was really serving some looks every time we saw him. Perhaps my favorite has to be this very subtle, understated costume with the lion over his shoulder. Mitchell, how did this happen? I'm obsessed with this.
I think, you know, I love subtlety. I had this character, Paris, who was supposed to be, you know, the gay bestie. And I was just trying to find ways. Ultimately, my lens into this whole movie was, how do you tell like a young adult story? If you were going to, I know what I would do with contemporary costumes. So I tried to take those instincts and filter them through all of this research that I had done about 15th century Italian costuming. And so in the ways that we would do a fur collar or, you know, extraordinary embellishments or prints and things like that, I felt like Paris would be dressing himself the same way that, you know, the gay bestie would today. So I started to look at, like, what are the extremes and what are the fashion forward things that we can put for this character that we understand he is a man trying to express himself in ways that other men of this time aren't. And so one of my first stops at the Met, I found this lion helmet.
Oh,
okay.
It was from the period. And it was just like such a bizarre little item that I kept in my camera roll on my phone for a while. And then I got to Italy and I'm in all the different museums. And I found this painting that had lion shoulder pieces on this armor. And then I started to swirl on that for a little while. And then in some of my research, I found that exotic pelts used to be worn. Like they were much more worn in terms of like ceremony or battle, or quite honestly, from what we can tell, mostly worn for paintings. But right. You know, if there's a man posing for a painting with a lion, that definitely speaks to the Paris that I'm trying to create. So I worked with an artist called Eastern Wind Studio who produces these faux replicas of different animals. And so I knew I wanted a lion. We imagined that Paris is a Leo, right? It would just make sense. So we came up with this huge lion shoulder mount that we plopped on top, and it served sort of as like a shoulder pad piece, poach,
some shoulder embellishment.
Yeah. I love it. I'm obsessed with this. You should probably wear something like this to perhaps a costume awards this year. I think that would really turn heads.
It's a quick lion mount.
Yeah.
So here now, I often don't exist in the real world when I come. I just get lost in the design of it all. And I sometimes lose myself in the practicalities of all of this. So at one point, my assistant, Mitchell Wolf, came up to me and is like, how are we getting this in the country? Because it was, of course, being built in the US.
Oh, right.
So we had to import a fake. I mean, it looks real. It looks like a real lion. Yeah. And it's all made with fake materials. You know, I think that the hair is, you know, like from a beauty salon, but it's done beautiful. It's dyed and it's meant to look real. So much so that if you touch it, like most of our crew did think it was real at one point. We had to kind of explain that this is like, you know, shaved polar fleece and
right.
human hair mane.
I have to say, I wasn't 100% either. I was like, I'm pretty sure it's faux, but
it does beautiful work. But then we got into this nightmare of importing a lion head through customs in Italy, trying to convince everybody that it's not real. Of course, Disney is famous for its no animal products on camera policy. So we had to prove to them with the artist that none of this was real. They were slightly concerned that it could be perceived as real. And, you know, it was a whole big swirl of a conversation. But as you can see, we landed the look. Mm-hmm. Sleepless nights about it, but it got there right on time.
Amazing. I imagine it going through like the x-ray at customs and like, what is that?
Yeah, definitely some flags raised across the border, I believe.
Right.
I love that. I love a good hat. And this movie was full of fantastic hats. The hats were just over the top and I loved it. Were these built for the film? Like, did you have a workshop or were most of them rentals?
Well, thank you for acknowledging hats. I don't know if any of your other guests have had this conversation with you, but for costume designers to get a hat on camera is like an act of Congress. Really? The DP wants to cut them. The producers want to cut them. People are so unfamiliar with wearing hats and seeing hats that it's very hard to get them on camera, even though all of the research would show you hats. You know, it was a pretty legendary battle that we had because, you know, I'm trying to do my job and be period correct in an environment of people who don't necessarily want that, right? And so right. My costume soul is like, but they wear hats. You know, we would be in these locations with these incredible mosaics and frescoes on the wall. And I would say to our team, our producing team, like, look at the research. It's on the walls. Everyone here is wearing a hat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But to a modern eye, hats can be distracting, especially of this period, because they were so over the top.
Yeah.
So it was a total battle. The director and I were really all about the hats and we had to fight those voices who didn't want them necessarily. So Elizabeth, thank you. I appreciate
it. Of course.
I appreciate the notice. But, you know, it's... it gave me a lot of perspective when I have looked at other costume designers' work and been like, well, that's not period. And then you realize like, well, there's a lot of voices that go into those conversations. And so if a costume designer can get close to period, it's a victory.
I love it.
Honestly, you're saying this and I'm like, because I've watched a couple of like those Renaissance like Netflix shows. And I'm really thinking, I'm like, wait, there were no hats like, or there were very few. And I'm like, oh, that's why.
I mean, the other battle we had was, so, you know, it's for most of human history, people have worn layers of clothing, right? We're now in a period where we're not super layered in the same way. But in this period, women would be wearing a chemise, which is like a chemise, basically under all of their dresses. And so often when you watch a modern take on a period show, the chemise is the first thing that gets cut because it's not understood by a modern audience. But for people who are paying attention and understand costumes, like you would never just throw a dress on top of the bare skin. It's a very modern idea, but it's often done in these modern takes on period films. So the Battle of the Chemise was a whole other thing. And I had to prove that you need the chemise underneath so that you can get those puffed sleeves, like the slash like, you know, at the shoulders and the elbows and at this neckline. It's like, it's for me, it's one of the most romantic parts about the period. And you have to have it in order to sell the look. But, you know, again, it's one of these details that doesn't really work to a modern eye. So it needs quite a bit of convincing to get it towards camera.
That's fast. I never would have thought that's like an issue.
Right. I'm so happy you won this battle because the hats really made the movie. I mean, I just can't imagine it without the hats. They were so good. I feel like we should bring these type of hats back, actually, if we're talking about it.
Go for it.
Especially, I think it was either Romeo's mom or Juliet's mom who had a hat that kind of looked like a taco. I thought that was really wonderful.
to answer Elizabeth's question, we had three in-house milliners who were, you know, more talented than the next. And so it was fantastic. I would bring them fabric and feathers and felts, and we would block out hats and trims. And it was like, you know, lovely to be there with them and experience the craft that they have. You know, it is a dying craft, right? The world is not full of milliners as it once was. So to work with people who are spend their lives making hats is like a real, it's a gift.
I love that. Like one of the first times I realized like, oh, I'm going to like this movie was when she's walking with her dad in that pink dress and he has the hat in his hands, but I had no idea what it was at first. I was like, what is in his hands? And then she puts it on. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that hat's fabulous. This is going to be good.
Mitchell, you did the thing. I basically jumped off the couch when I realized that I was looking at Minnie Driver in this film playing Nurse Janet. She looked incredible, even if she was in a more traditional look. She actually spoke about her role in the film. I just wanted to read that quote for Elizabeth and Mitchell. She said, her character is much more engaging than the traditional nurse role in Romeo and Juliet. It was the worst part at drama school. Nobody ever wanted to be the nurse because it was like the boring old person. But now in this, she's obviously youthful and vigorous and extremely funny. I was thrilled to be a part of this whole thing with all these lovely people because they're all good souls. They're all lovely, good humans, and that's what's most important. That was from a website called As the Bunny Hops. Mitchell, what was it like working with Minnie Driver?
A career high, for sure. It's Minnie Driver, you know?
Yeah, right.
And the cool thing is, like, she is an actress who loves costumes.
Oh, yeah. We just did Phantom of the Opera a few months ago, so.
And I got to talk to her about that. I mean, that costume is, like, one of the best of all time. But it was great. She had just been, she had just come from working with Ellen Mirojnik. And so, you know, she was, like, high on costumes, of course, after Ellen. And, it was really fun because she loves all the details like we do. She, you know, she wants to get it on and live in it a little bit and talk about, you know, for the nurse character, we got into the breakdown a little bit. It wasn't this perfectly polished costume. And so we got into the breakdown together. She wanted to understand like how we were going to tie the fabric on top of the head and the smocking on the apron and how it would be worn. And she loves to know all of the history of what she's in so that she can inhabit it best. And I just find that that's such a wonderful relationship to have with an actor who wants to acknowledge the work that's gone into their costume and understands the references that you're pulling from so that she can, she can inhabit it a bit better. So it was a real joy to work with her.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. She did amazing. And it was just so good to see her. We need more Minnie Driver roles. Honestly, I'm just obsessed with her.
Bring them on. I'll watch all of them.
Right. I was like, Elizabeth, I almost text her, but she's 3 hours ahead. I'm like, you didn't tell me Minnie Driver was in this as I was watching it.
Let's take a second and talk about Romeo and Dario. They both certainly have unique styles and silhouettes. Romeo's feels a bit more like guarded and Dario's much more inviting. What was your idea behind the two characters?
It was really fun because in the same way that we had this relation or the difference between Rosalind and Juliet, it echoes itself a bit in the relationships between Dario and Romeo. So the girls were all chasing Romeo. And so we wanted that sort of like peacock, right? Someone who's like really into fashion and accessorizes himself. I did lose my battle of a pearl earring on Romeo. I wanted that dangle that we're seeing right now. Yeah. Because men were wearing earrings at the time. Yeah. So to just give a modern audience something that they could relate to in the same way that we look at the carrot hair and the little earring right now. I wanted the same to be true of our Romeo. But it was all about using elements of masculine dress, but taking them to their extremes. So the boots became thigh highs, the capes became trains. And so it was an exaggeration of elements that existed in paintings, but just taking it to the point of extremes and frivolity. Whereas Dario is much more rugged. It's about like leather and studs and simplicity, honestly, against the other costumes in the film. It sort of takes a lesser tone, the quiet tone, which I think is part of the draw for Rosalind. Like, he is the one who gets overlooked. And then you realize he's been the sturdy, practical companion that she's been looking for the whole film.
Wow. I love that. Total sidebar, but did anyone on set mention that Romeo was giving kind of Heath Ledger vibes throughout this?
So the second we had the wig, we were like, oh my God, this is Heath, right?
Right. Okay. I'm not crazy the whole time.
I mean, Kyle acknowledges that comparison, that just the facial structure, they truly right. look like each other.
Right. I mean, he did a fantastic job as Romeo, but the comparison is there for sure.
Absolutely, yes. And the hair length specifically, right? It took us all back to that young Heath.
It was beautiful, actually. I think Romeo's, you know, the costume we see a lot of the images coming from. I love that like black, strong shoulder moment. That's one of my favorite costumes.
All built. We made it all.
Okay. All right. So, Mitchell, this was a beautiful film and brought so much joy and comfort. Even Elizabeth enjoyed it, and she notoriously has beef with William Shakespeare. So clearly something right happened here. But this project just came off to me as a dream project. I mean, you're shooting in Italy. It's all gorgeous. You're doing all this inspiration. What did this experience mean to you personally, professionally, you know, looking back on it all?
It was a real pinch me job. I mean, I got to work with my favorite part of my job is the people always. Like I love a good script, but I love a good crew and I love a good cast just as much. So I am always humbled when I get to work with people who have devoted their lives to craftsmanship. So weavers, milliners, stitchers, drapers, tailors, like those are my people. I love to work with them. And so to get to run a costume shop in Rome at one of the most beautiful times of the year and be able to, you know, go to Venice for the masks, right? Like we're doing a masked ball, just hop down to Venice and get some masks taken care of. It's just a real pinch me moment where you recognize the opportunities that this career path can provide you. You know, it asks a lot of you. You really have to devote most of your waking hours to the project whenever you're working on it. But if you do it right and you like the people that you work with, it can really be so, so rewarding. So it was very hard to say no to a project that's going to let you do period costume for a period that's not often done on film. There's not a ton of movies that you can look to for this period. So to be able to do that, to be able to work with the people I got to work with, it was just like a real, how did I get here moment.
Yeah. I mean, we loved it. Congratulations, Mitchell. This was such a joy. I'm trying to think of another Italian Renaissance film and nothing's coming to mind. I mean, this is our favorite.
I mean, it's also hard for it not to, you have to be careful that it doesn't just become like a Ren Faire, right?
Right.
There's
a lot that's of, very, like, so true.
A lot of bad Ren Faire costumes out there that you have to be able to discern the difference between what's based in reality, what's based on fantasy. There's a lot of crossover between the Renaissance and fantasy costumes. So keeping things on the side of history versus, you know, design is a hard line to find.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mitchell, but we're not done quite yet. Would you like to play a little game with us?
Absolutely.
Hit the track, Daniel.
The one costume to rule them all.
My look actually changed over the span of this interview. Originally, it was Paris's look with the black hat and the long feathers, just because I want that hat so bad. And it has like the awesome necklace and the fur detail. But I know this is kind of a shocky choice for me, but I went to the dragonfly dress just because I just fell in love with the story. It's not something, I'm not a romantic person. I would never go for something red or with, you know, butterflies or dragonflies.
No, you wouldn't.
I fell in love with the, you know, that's so not my choice, but I fell in love with the symbolism of it. And I love the research that went to it and the storytelling and, you know, trend forecasting in the 1400s. I mean, most people think trend forecasting starts in 1920. So it's kind of, my mind was blown. So Mitchell, I changed my look.
I'll take it.
I love that. I also love a just like a crazy costume that doesn't have like too much screen time, but looks fabulous. So I went with Paris's lion head shoulder piece look just because I love the work that went behind it. And just like, it's such a gorgeous piece, but he's also just kind of like in the background. He's like, yes, I'm here. I look great, look better than all of you. So I'm just going to go around with my shoulder piece that is far too big, but looks incredible. So that was my one costume to rule them all.
Right. Was that the night that he was announcing his wedding too, or his marriage?
His engagement. Yeah.
Right. And he's trying to be like, it's not a big deal, but yet he's taking advantage of this moment for a wedding he doesn't care about.
I think if Paris knows there's a spotlight on a moment, he's going to occupy that spotlight.
Absolutely.
All right, Mitchell, what is your one costume to rule them all?
Okay. My one costume to rule them all would be the pearl dress that Rosalind wears for her battle sequence.
Oh.
We built four, I think three or four of them in the end. And it was a real like testament to our team because the fabrics came from Spain. The pearls came from New York. It was built in Spain and Rome. And it was just like, everybody firing on all cylinders to get this dress done on time with the multiples. And it was just one of those things, like it was really down to the wire. I mean, people were sewing the morning that it was working. And it was just really gratifying to know that you can pull off what seems impossible. And it was like, it looks like the dress in my mind, which is, I'm always working to shorten that gap, the dress in my mind versus the dress on camera. So much can happen in between, so many, you know, opinions, shipping delays, fabric, so many things can change. And so when they get really close to that dress in my mind, that's gotta be my costume to rule them all.
I love that one. I know exactly which one you're talking about. It's definitely some of my favorites too.
I love that. That was a very cool one.
And I just want to go on the record as saying to all my fellow costume designers, it is time to start picking favorites. No more. That's lethal. I want to know. Pick a favorite.
Yeah, for everyone who's listening, we always give the designers a choice. Most of them decide to say they'd rather not choose a favorite, which I understand. But then it's like, you know, is Brad Pitt going to listen to this and be like, they didn't pick my costume, you know, type of thing? You know, so I think we're okay here.
Nah, just pick, right? So
with that, Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us. This was such a treat. I love this. What a great way to start our Shakespeare month. I mean, it doesn't get better than this.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Mitchell. This has been such a joy. And thank you for listening to the podcast and supporting us. You know, we love everything you do. And I'm just excited for the next thing that we could get you on here for. You're one of our favorites.
Aw, don't. Don't make me blush. Come on.
Be sure, everyone, if you love all these stories, you know, Mitchell occasionally posts some great costumes on his Instagram. Follow him at @_MitchellTravis_. Check out some of these costumes for yourself. They're great.
And if you want to weigh in on which costume ruled them all, you can leave us a voicemail at 626-515-1826, or you can email us at theartofcostumeblogcast@gmail.com. Spencer, what are we watching next week?
Well, I think you're Rosie. Your love for Romeo and Juliet, it's probably going to be short-lived because next week we are watching the most Romeo and Juliet story of them all. The Romeo and Juliet directed by Baz Luhrmann. It's quite a, it's a good one. You're going to love it, Elizabeth.
Can't wait.
I'm sure everything's going to work out in the end of this one.
Surely.
If If you love this episode, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at The Art of Costume Pod, TikTok at The Art of Costume, where we'll be posting clips from this episode. Don't forget, we have a merch store at theartofcostume.com/podstore. And when you have a chance, don't forget to leave us a 5-star text review on Apple Podcasts. It really does help. Mitchell, this has been such a joy. Elizabeth, it's good seeing you. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you. Have a good week.
The Art of Costume blogcast is hosted and produced by Elizabeth Joy Glass and Spencer Williams. Our audio engineering and editing is done by Dan White. Follow us on Instagram at The Art of Costume Pod or visit theartofcostumeblogcast.com for all blogcast updates. If you want to support the show, go to theartofcostume.com/podstore. For more costume reviews, deep dives, and interviews, head over to theartofcostume.com, a blog dedicated to highlighting the best in costume design.
We're really excited about this one, especially because Elizabeth is notorious for not liking Romeo and Juliet.
Hate I think Romeo this might Juliet. Be...
That's
and I loved this movie.